Movie theaters are modern-day pulpits. Real-world theology exists to shed a light on the narratives that are shaping our culture, and to remind viewers that entertainment is not mindless.
Welcome to Real World Theology's very first year interview slash Oscar preview show. What we hope to do is look back on 2016 and evaluate it as a whole while also having some fun by doing our best at picking Oscar winners. For this episode, I have gathered a very special panel of guests who have all the opinions on this past year in film. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce from Real World Theology... and a clear lens, and who knows what else he's doing. Gene Goosewet Paper. Hey, Gene.
That one is reaching there, Mikey. Hello, how are you? It's great to be on the show with three guys with their own podcast and me.
Are you sure? Because I don't know who the other guests are. Oh, yes, I do. Guest number two from the Feel and Film podcast, Aaron White. What's up, Aaron?
Hey, thanks for having me. It's going to be a good one, I think.
You think?
I think.
You think?
I'm hopeful.
Okay. Well, I'm feeling good about it, so. Let's see. And to round out our panel, the one, the only, infamously, from the Story Men and the Don't Split Up podcast, and again, from various other podcasts that I'm sure he'll tell you about at the end of the show, J.R. Forresteros. What's up, J.R.?
Nothing. I managed to watch almost all the movies that I was assigned for this, so I feel pretty good about myself.
I like to think you did nothing else today but watch these films.
I sacrificed going to see Lego Batman so I could be more prepared for this episode.
I thought most of you know what a big...
No.
Oh. Oh.
My wife had a roller derby bout this weekend, uh-huh. And so that kind of put a crimp in our movie scene stuff. So.
Yeah. But, you know, I mean, I don't. You obviously made the right decision.
Because, oh, for sure.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Because she can beat me up.
Yeah, that's true. She's very awesome. Well, I know we want to keep this to a timely, listener-sensitive kind of framework. So I'm just going to jump right in. And usually I get to ask whoever's on Skype the question first, but you're all on Skype. Which is amazing. I have all these great movie film people, and I guess I've met JR. So, you know, sorry, JR.
How could you forget that, yeah. Mikey?
Well, I was going to say, for the greater Real World Theology community, which you guys are representing, it's amazing how we have had so many great discussions about 2016, and most of us, outside of a couple small connections, have not had a chance to even see each other face to face, which I just think is great. It's the success story of the internet for all its failings. So,
like after the apocalypse, when they're telling stories like Mad Max style, right?
Yeah,
this will be the one of the internet.
Yeah, when they only have like bards, like back in Greek days. And
they'll be like, Al Gore invented this thing so that this other thing called real world theology could exist.
It'll be epic poetry.
Yeah.
And it'll be tremendous. It'll be tremendous. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to go in alphabetical order. So
woohoo!
That means Aaron is going to get to answer questions, at least the first question first. So, Aaron, what I am curious about is when you think back on 2016, for you, what were some of the highlights and lowlights? Like what were you feeling in 2016?
Well, the first thing I was feeling was broke because I saw a lot of movies this year or last year.
I'm feeling light in the wallet.
I mean, I think I triple or quadrupled my single year count for films in a theater, and it was awesome but also a challenge. For me, highlights, specific movies, of course, you know, La La Land was a big one for me. Hell or High Water was my number one film of the year for a good 3 months, 4 months or so. That was a real highlight, just seeing that one and not having any expectations or knowledge about it beforehand, it's always nice for me when I know nothing about a movie and I just kind of like, oh, hey, what's this movie? I'm just going to go sit down on a weekend or a weekday afternoon and watch it and then get blown away by it. A big highlight for me was faith-based films. And I know that, let me explain.
No, that's fine. I think I'm with you on this one.
Yeah. The ones that I'm referring to are, of course, Silence, Risen, and Last Days in the Desert. All three of those I really enjoyed, and they caused me to sit and chew and think and dive into the Bible a little bit and really evaluate how good a faith-based film could be when it wasn't trying to be a faith-based film. So that was a highlight for me.
Well, I'd also push back a little and say that in some of those cases, those might not be considered faith-based films, which is probably why you're enjoying them to some degree. Risen was I think borderline still a faith-based film. But, you know, like with something like Hacksaw Ridge or Silence, I think we finally saw faith being portrayed in more honest ways, which means they weren't faith-based films. They were reality-based films about people of faith.
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly.
And I know I'm kind of like, going around just to kind of work on semantics. But I think that is important to delineate because while some faith-based films are improving in quality, we still are only really seeing films that are making us think outside of that in a way that people are being depicted more honestly and faith in our world is being depicted a little more honestly where it doesn't necessarily tie up with a bow. But you know, I love those thoughts. So Gene, I'm kind of curious, you know, one of the things that I have said a lot, and I know a lot of people have kind of, I don't want to say agreed with me because it makes me sound amazing, but like a lot of people have kind of talked about this same thing is like 2016 has been kind of a letdown in the year of film. So I'm kind of curious, what were some highlights and lowlights and, you know, what did you think of 2016 as a film year?
Yeah, I think certainly with blockbuster movies, they really missed the mark in a lot of ways. There were some that I think were better than others. I did think Civil War was pretty good this year. But then you had a lot of others like the BFG, Ghostbusters. They just kind of came and went without much noise. So in that respect, it was a little bit of a disappointment that these movies that we were looking so forward to at the beginning of the year really didn't deliver what we were hoping for. So that'd be a low light, and that kind of everyone is sort of acknowledging that. But to jump on the faith-based film thing that Aaron was talking about, I think at the beginning of the year, I feel like every other week or every third week or so, we were getting some new release of a faith-based film, whether it be something like Risen, which I think pushes the standard a little further ahead, or something like God's Not Dead 2, which like pulls it back.
He reins it back in.
So, but what we're seeing is the acknowledgement, and it really started, I think, maybe a full bore probably 3 or 4 years ago for more major studios. But the acknowledgement that the Christian audience is a marketable audience, and you can make movies that pander to them and just tell them what they want to hear and give them confirmation bias, or you can tell really good stories that happen to be involving people of a spiritual background. So like Hacksaw Ridge and Silence were good examples of the latter. I think Risen is probably a decent mix of the two. I think the story was not too bad. And then you have stuff like God's Not Dead 2. You have the prayer movie. What was that? Was that 2016 or 2015? Yeah, War Room.
I think
it was at the end of
2015. Late 2015. So you got stuff like we're seeing a much healthier mix, though, I think, than we were 5 to 10 years ago. So yeah. I think that would be a highlight. I think that sort of genre is being pushed in the right direction. So it has me anxious for where we'll be, you know, 10 years from now. Maybe we'll kind of get back to how Christian stories were sort of classically told, you know, in the kind of the 50s and 60s era of Hollywood. So I would say, from our perspective, I would say that was a good highlight.
Cool. JR, so I'm really curious how you're feeling about this. One of the things that I really was excited to have you on for is because since we couldn't get some other voices as well, it solely lands on you to bring us the horror genre. And
I was gonna say horror. Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm kind of curious.
What
you thought, specifically with horror, but then again, overall highlights, lowlights. You know, did 2016 disappoint in some ways? You know, did it? Whatever. So, what were your thoughts?
Well, let's just get this out of the way. DC totally crapped the bag.
talk about horrible.
I mean,
films.
Yeah. Those. Uh-oh. I mean, I know not all of us on this episode hated Suicide Squad, but I actually...
What?
Once I chewed on it, I actually liked Suicide Squad less than Batman v Superman, which I didn't think was even possible.
Yeah.
So, and you know, Marvel, though, on the other hand, you had, like, I agree with Gene, Civil War was... Civil War did lose some of its luster as I thought about it. I've rewatched it a couple times, and it's really more of, like, a really great airport fight sequence with a pretty decent movie wrapped around it.
Yeah.
Like, as I've watched the movie, I keep being like, man, I really can't wait to get that airport scene. And then that happens, and I'm kind of like, all right, maybe I'll just rewind that, or I'm, you know. But it is a well-told story. It's coherent. It's got, they build so well in what they've done. Doctor Strange was fantastic. It made my top 10 this year. Mm. I just thought it was cool. Super fun, even though it was basically like Iron Man with magic.
Now, if Doctor Strange made your top 10, what about Deadpool? Was that up there?
So I was choosing between Deadpool and Doctor Strange, and it really just came down to personal preference for the character for me. Doctor Strange is one of my all-time favorites. He's one of the only comics I collect pretty consistently. But yeah, Deadpool was the other one I was going to say is, like, again, especially compared against the completely forgettable X-Men Apocalypse. Like, Deadpool.
I actually did forget about X-Men Apocalypse.
So did I until you just now said it.
There you go. Like, so case in point. And again, those are two films that are ostensibly set in the same universe, and they could not have been more different in terms of, like, what they brought to superhero movies, you mm-hmm. know? And so, yeah, I don't know. Like, it was that was such a mixed bag for me. And I know that all of us are geeks. We like that kind of stuff. So, but yeah, for horror, I don't know what is in. I mean, probably the fact that the last couple of years have been increasingly divisive in our culture. And it seems like, you know, we're undergoing a pretty seismic shift in terms of national identity. And that just tends to create good horror, because horror is really about trying to get to the root of humanity, human identity. And man, this was an incredible year for horror. Some of them were films that came out last year and got picked up at Sundance and released this year, like The Witch,
yeah.
Under the Shadow. But like Neon Demon, that movie kind of, I heard a bunch of buzz about it, and it's very divisive, but I was transfixed by it. There are a couple of Korean movies that were just bananas. The Wailing has a Korean exorcism scene, and oh my gosh.
Korean exorcism?
Exactly.
That's a thing?
Like, it's apparently.
I think everyone can have exorcisms equally, Aaron.
Yeah, it's crazier than you can imagine. And no. I don't know, like the Exorcist TV show, which I know this is about movies, but like the Exorcist TV show that was on a network, like Fox, it was on network, broadcast network TV,
yeah,
was incredible. Like one of the best things all year. Under the Shadows was an Iranian horror film that was set during the Iran-Iraq war back in the 80s. That was just fantastic. Mm. 10 Cloverfield Lane. I don't know. I mean, I do know because it was a genre film, but like why John Goodman wasn't in any of the best supporting actor lists. He was absolutely incredible in that movie.
Except for the Real World Theology best supporting actor.
Well, yeah, of course. Yeah, yeah. did we invite him to the award show? He just declined?
We're still waiting to hear back.
So, yeah. Okay, yeah.
Mr. Goodman, huge fans. Love to have you on the show.
That's right.
The Purge election year was like, I don't know.
Was that good?
It was pretty good.
Well, I mean,
liked it. I thought it was.
Yeah, if you like the Purge movies.
Yeah.
And this one did some really interesting commentary on religion, like very explicitly.
It did, yeah.
I found fun. I have enjoyed this, especially once they got past the first Purge movie, which is basically just an excuse to do a home invasion movie where they couldn't call the cops.
Yeah.
Like now that they're actually into the serious social commentary,
mm-hmm.
they're pretty interesting. So, yeah, I mean, Hush, I don't know if any of you saw Hush.
I did. I thought it was really good. Yeah, I loved Mike Gallagher Jr., and that was a very different, role.
It's a deaf author who goes to a cabin in the woods to write and basically gets harassed by a psycho. And she's deaf obviously plays a huge role in the film. So, I don't know. There were just tons of good horror movies this year.
That's crazy. I still haven't heard you mention Green Room or The Conjuring 2. Yeah. I mean, we're talking about the films that actually people were looking forward to. You've not mentioned a lot of those. You've mentioned
all these Green Room. Green Room was on my best of list. I gave Conjuring 2, Lights Out, Ouija 2. I gave those an honorable mention because those are basically just jump scare movies. Don't Breathe. Yeah. Oh man. So it's been a great year for horror. 2017 is shaping up to be another great year. And you look through that list, very few of those are sequels or remakes. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't even count 10 Cloverfield Lane as a sequel, even though it's like technically set in the same something, maybe sort of like it was a totally original piece of, you know, filmmaking. So
I feel like we're bordering on what I'm very curious about next. I mean, so we can talk about cinematic impact or cultural impact, but I think especially with being on Real World Theology, what we like to talk about is theme. And story, because story is going to have a theme and stuff like that. So when we talk about theme, every year I feel like I look back on the previous year and it seems to have some kind of a rise of a particular type of film or a theme that kind of runs through a lot of the films, or, you know, something that really stands out. And I know, Gene, you had a really great article talking about some themes that really stood out to you in 2016. Some themes that may have even saved the movie, an otherwise bad movie year for you. So I'm curious, you know, we've talked about horror, and JR, when you talk about horror, you're talking about exploring identity, and we've talked about faith-based films and how characters with faith are more prevalent and then not shunned. Like we're actually enjoying these films. So I feel like we're dancing around it. And Gene, I'd like to throw this to you first. What themes stood out to you? What kind of connections between films did you see being made? What did you see people really flocking to this year? And kind of what films would be examples of that?
What were people flocking to? A lot of people were flocking to the blockbusters to start and then immediately flocked away. But I think you were talking about what I identified at the end of the year. And I in the article, I was talking about children being representative, and specifically children going through some sort of trauma or loss or what have you. But I think I might, just looking at my list throughout the year, I might just expand that to just general family dramas. And I know that's not any kind of a unique theme to have for a year. That's a fairly common type of story to be telling. But family dramas, in particular, that hinge upon children making big decisions or going through monumental things. Earlier in the year, you have stuff like Jungle Book, which isn't necessarily the typical family drama, but you have a boy being raised by wolves, of course. So it's telling a very familiar tale, and he's trying to identify who his family is, where he belongs, how it is he stands out in his immediate community. You have something like Midnight Special, which is Michael Shannon taking care of his son and recognize that he has this special ability. So his son is going through this sort of trauma, and it's a kind of a microcosm family drama. Fundamentals of Caring, which is one that I really liked, which was on Netflix, which, by the way, I wanted to also mention, I think another highlight of 2016, which has been ramping up throughout the years, is that we're seeing more and more original content on streaming services that's becoming really contenders with a lot of these major motion pictures. The Lobster is another one from Amazon Studios. Fundamentals of Caring, like I said, I think Sing Street was from Netflix, if I'm not mistaken. So you got a lot of stuff like that. But in terms of theme, I think family dramas with a particular view on children and what children are having to deal with was a pretty big impact in 2016.
So if you had to kind of nail down what it is. Like, what? Why are people connecting with kid perspective?
So the children bring out kind of the children inside each and every one of us. We immediately begin to talk like babies every time we're around babies. And whenever we're around 5 or 6 year olds, we immediately kind of filter our language to talk like they talk. And we immediately try to identify with them and get on their level. And I think when you have stories with children that are powerful stories to start with, throwing children in there immediately endears the audience to them and makes them want to get on their level, just like we do interact with children in our everyday lives. We want to get on their level, and we want to kind of not necessarily live vicariously through them, but we want to feel all the emotions that they're feeling sort of fresh and new as children. And being sort of unconditionally loving of their parents, you know, not recognizing any faults in their parents, just loving them just from the get-go, is something that I think we all kind of want to, you know, remember back to that kind of feeling when we just loved somebody. There wasn't any kind of drama going on with it, or there wasn't any baggage to go along with it. We just wanted it to be simple, unfiltered love of somebody. And I think stories with children going through emotionally traumatic events really brings that out in people, and is a great opportunity to connect with characters in the stories.
Yeah, I think the thing I liked about, or that I think the thing I reflected on after I read your article was the fact that, in a world where we, you know, what seems to be lauded is complex emotion, like, oh, that story was so, you know, complicated, it had so many moving parts, you know, the emotional depth and the dialogue was so intense and so well written. Yeah. Like, sometimes when you strip everything away and you just look at it like a child, it makes almost the most basic of emotional responses or the basic of situations more real, because you're not trying to hyper-stylize it. You're just trying to capture, like, what is sadness or what is joy or what is surprise. And
are you just naming Inside Out characters?
I am. Surprise, my favorite Inside Out character. I mean, that's why.
Yeah, that's a good point.
So, yeah, I mean, so I just, like, I think I hope I'm with you on that one. It was, like I said, that's why I liked your write-up that you can find at realworldtheology.com so much, because, like I said, I think it was a pretty astute thing. So, Aaron, same thing. What did you notice? Did you notice any similarities between films, or any common themes or ideas that kept jumping out at you? Like I said, I know you mentioned that faith-based films really kind of had a spotlight on them, but is there anything else?
Yeah, there were two things, and they're not as nuanced, I guess, as something like Gene. Gene had to dig for his, man. I loved your article because it was not something I connected immediately throughout the year, and I think that's great, you know, to be able to go back and see it, you know, in hindsight and go, oh man, you're right. Both of mine, I feel like, were pretty on the nose themes. The first one being just grief in general. Mm-hmm. This was a tough year. This was a tough year to be at the movies, because there were a lot of movies that made us, if not cry, at least get really emotional. I mean, we had A Monster Calls, Manchester by the Sea, Jackie, Captain Fantastic, Moonlight, Arrival, Kubo.
Yeah.
I mean, even in La La Land, Ryan Gosling is mourning the loss of Jazz. So, I mean, grief is everywhere.
Hashtag first world problems.
In 2016, it's everywhere. And I mean, real talk though, it wrecked me quite a few times. I mean, we did the Arrival episode together, Mikey, and mm-hmm. You know, that was a big one, because when we're talking grief, even if the exact story we're seeing depicted on screen is not something we've experienced, it's an emotion that we can always relate to by something else that's happened in our life. We don't have to have been in that exact position. I mean, most of us have not dealt with what happens in Manchester by the Sea, but we're able to imagine it or to relate to it in different ways. And I think that these films offered us a lot of different views of the grieving process. how a kid grieves in A Monster Calls versus, you know, how grieving is done in Captain Fantastic, they're completely different. And it's not to say one is right and one is wrong. It's just to say that this is life. Manchester by the Sea, this is real grieving. Mm-hmm. This is something we all have to get through. And so I really appreciated that, but I also am really looking forward to and hoping for a year off from that 2017.
Give my eyeballs a break.
Yeah, exactly. I need to rest from that. But
it's the first time Gene's cried in like 12 years. You know,
it is. He got to
Aaron. You can tell him about our bet.
Yeah. So I actually bet Gene that he was going to cry, and he took it. And
in general in 2016, or like for a specific movie?
No, at A Monster Call specifically. Okay. We were in a comment thread and going back and forth, and everybody was saying how they cried. There was like, you know, fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth. And Gene's like, I'm not going to cry. And everyone's like, yeah, you are. And so we made a bet that, you know, whoever, if he cried, he'd have to watch a movie of my choice, and then vice versa if he didn't. And he did. He did shed a tear. So he got to watch Kroll.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, lucky guy.
Got to watch Kroll, yeah. Interesting way to phrase that. I got to watch it.
And then he even live tweeted it for me. It was awesome.
That was pretty fun. That was pretty fun. No, I feel like I'm notorious for not crying. I could before this year, at least, I could count on one hand the number of movies I've cried at, and two of them are Pixar movies, actually. Mm-hmm. So this year, I think I full on cried it during two movies, and I teared up pretty heavily in three or four other movies. So it was, Aaron, I think you nailed it. It was a big year for grief in general.
And it makes sense too. And I'm going to segue quickly into my second thing.
That's fine.
This year being such a political nightmare, for lack of a better word, grief is an interesting concept for us to be tackling, because we're all mourning right now in a big sense. We're mourning for our country. We're mourning for the loss of rights. We're mourning for the people that are being marginalized and shut out of this country. Used to we just have to fight against abortion, and now we've got to, you know, fight for just refugees or people who, you know, just want to come here and have a burger, who are being turned away. So we're all experiencing this in so many ways right now. And the other theme that I really felt was strong was like a reverse of Oscar's So White. And that is just the focus on race this year. And I don't know that I say focus, and I don't mean that in a negative way, but we had amazing films. We had a lot of documentaries. We had OJ Made in America, 13th, I Am Not Your Negro. I don't know if you guys have seen these. But then we also had Fences and Moonlight and Hidden Figures, mm-hmm. The People vs. OJ Simpson. Lots of films that were really great looks and realistic looks into the history of race in our country and kind of how we got to where we are today. Not in a preachy manner, not in a very loud and protesting Black Lives Matter, you know, kind of manner, but in a, hey, look at history, look at the facts of what took place. And then maybe you can start to see what decisions were made and where people went wrong. And so maybe we could start to make some changes in the country, I hope. And so whether these films are getting recognition a little bit because of Oscar So White last year, maybe they're trying to kind of reverse that trend. For example, Moonlight, I would say is a movie that I don't necessarily see being a Best Picture nominee 2 or 3 years ago. I just don't. I don't feel like it was made to be that, but it's got a little bit of a spotlight on it because we're looking for that now. And, you know, thank goodness, because it's an amazing movie. And it's awesome that it's getting the recognition that it is. So
yeah, I was gonna say, I don't think it would have got the marketing as Best Picture a couple years ago. Not that it wouldn't have been, you know,
that's what I mean. Not the quality. Yeah,
not for technical merit, but just, I think people would have been like, well, that's never going to win.
So those two things I think are just incredibly timely themes from last year that were huge for me in going to the movies.
Mm. I definitely see that a lot too. And I love that you hit on both of those, because I honestly have had to ask one of those like very introspective questions, because when I looked at the Best Picture nominees, and we'll talk about this later when we actually talk about the Oscars specifically, I was like, I just don't know that I would have selected some of those films for Best Film. But I'm kind of wondering if there is some fear that they're going to get a hashtag Oscars so white again. And then I go, yeah. Well, maybe it's just 2016, because there's some, you know, I don't think Hacksaw Ridge, like, again, we'll talk about this later, but I think there's some films with mainly just white people in them that I didn't think necessarily deserved a Best Picture nod either. So I'm just kind of curious what that would have looked like if last year didn't happen. But at the same time, except for the fact that occasionally someone will stand up and say Hidden Fences was a great film this year.
You mean Hidden Figures?
Well, that's what I'm saying.
Well, no, but that was said, though.
That was said at the Golden Globes, more than once.
Oh, it was. I missed that.
Yeah, they referred to Hidden Fences. You know,
that's funny.
So it's always interesting to have, you know, those kind of gaffes when people don't really, or they haven't taken time to pay enough attention to distinguish between two of the major like black films or black character focused films that have been made. So, but grieving especially is something that I noticed. And I was the same way. There are so many films. I've well documented this on the podcast. If you've listened to any other episodes of the podcast where we talk about anything that's even remotely emotional, ever since I have had, my son, I cry all the time now, basically. And so like Arrival, Manchester by the Sea, even Kubo, and I didn't even really like the ending all that much, and I'm still kind of like, oh, that's sweet. I mean, for what it's worth, I somehow didn't cry during A Monster Calls. Maybe the pressure was too high, but you know, like all
you're like, is now where I'm supposed to cry? Yeah, wait, like, is it now? Wait, should I be crying right now?
Does Liam Neeson, if I cry, is he gonna hurt me? I'm not sure.
You could have watched Krull.
Yeah.
You could have watched
Krull. Well, I've seen Krull. I didn't need to be dared to watch Krull. Because I know a good movie when I hear it, you know? But, you know, like Arrival, I'm just like, it broke me down. Like, I have, that combination of kids and grieving had just, it just pierced through me. And I would say that it saved an otherwise pretty lackluster 2016. Like, I wish I didn't have to wait till like late November before I started enjoying the films that I watched in 2016. But I want to make sure I give JR a chance to tackle this question too. So JR, especially if you want to talk about some of the things that the horror was tackling, I don't want to put you in a box, but in general, what did you see kind of woven through 2016?
Well, I mean, I would actually just sort of combine what Aaron and Gene said, and horror really touched on this as well. I think in general, I mean, our culture is undergoing a seismic shift in composition, and that necessarily means, you know, 5 years from now, we're going to be a completely different culture, a completely different country, just purely in terms of makeup, of composition. And as we saw in the 2016 election, that generated a lot of anger and anxiety. And I think that what I saw in a lot of the films of 2016 was trying to process change, whether that's change because of death or change like Gene brought up, Midnight Special, right, where all of a sudden my kid is different somehow. And it was essentially like a puberty story on steroids, right? Like I've got to teach my changing son how to live in this new world, sort of, and like keep him safe and all that kind of stuff. I just think running through all of that was there are all of these different films that are trying to grapple with the fact that we do change really badly. And we react to it in a lot of really negative ways. Arrival, right, was a great illustration of that. Manchester by the Sea, Moonlight. I mean, with this kid's emerging sexuality, and then the reactions. I think Dory was in some ways, you know, even kind of touching on that, as forgettable as that movie was. Certainly, yeah. Moana was. So, I mean, yeah, like, I just think all over the place you see a lot of that. That's essentially what all of the Purge movies are doing in their social critique. That's definitely what a film like Under the Shadow is doing, and that's a foreign film. I think you look at things like La La Land and Hail Caesar that are pining for the good old days and talking about how great Hollywood used to be, and they're like these love letters to, you know, an era gone by. And then you have a horror film like The Witch that specifically positions itself back in the good old days and shows like, well, actually, there's something pretty monstrous at the end of that, you know. So, yeah, for me, that was what it was, is I sort of, you know, I see the change that's happening in our culture and I see the anxiety around that. And then I see a bunch of films that are all in some way trying to get at maybe even just sort of grieving our inability to change well. And like, you always, grief is always inherent in the change process. Because you're all like, no one likes change because you're losing something familiar and comfortable. Mm-hmm. And so you have to grieve to change. And if you don't, I mean, that's what the stages, we even have the stages of grief, right? Denial, anger, bargain. And so you see a lot of that in a lot of these films. And I don't know, that's kind of where it hit me as I was looking back over the year. Civil War, even. I mean, I don't know.
Yeah. No, I mean, like Civil War does fit in that too. I think you just basically made a correlation that I expect someone to write a film essay on using 2016 and matching up a film for each stage of the stages of grief.
Yeah.
So someone get on that. There's your PhD deal. So we've talked about grieving so much. One thing that I had not thought until we were kind of having this discussion is that for me, and I'm hoping that you guys can give me some examples to the contrary, but I felt like 2016 was not a funny year. I think we usually get like half a dozen pretty funny comedies, and I feel like we got maybe three, and Nice Guys being one of them, and Nice Guys even being like not a typically laugh out loud kind of comedy, not like
a standard comedy.
Yeah, not a standard comedy. Like Shane Black being like really clever and kind of like hearty chuckle, kind of funny, like the kind of funny that sticks with you.
Are we doing Golden Globes definition of comedy, or are we doing
like The Martian? Or like
right? Yeah.
Well, Deadpool is hilarious.
Right. Yeah. I mean, Deadpool, La La Land, Hail Caesar. I liked Ghostbusters. I laughed a lot during that. I heard Sausage Party was hilarious, but I didn't see it. Central Intelligence, I thought was super funny.
I thought Central Intelligence was hilarious too.
Yeah. So I have
but there weren't a lot. There weren't a lot.
I have three movies that were really funny, and that was Nice Guys, Deadpool, and then Popstar, Never Stopping. and then like a second tier would be like Central Intelligence. I mean, and then some of the other films you mentioned, like, I think are funny, but like, it's like Marvel funny. Like, I chuckle sometimes, but it's not really a comedy. I wanted more hilarious. I wanted more reasons to laugh in 2016.
Oh, wait, what about Keanu?
See, Keanu.
I still haven't seen it. Oh, I need to see it.
Well,
see,
I laugh super hard at Keanu.
I'm a cat lover too.
I think Keanu was actually what I felt like you've described most of the other films in 2016 being kind of being like, you can enjoy it for the moment, but it's almost instantly forgettable. I thought there were two or three maybe really funny like sketches in Keanu, and then the rest of it was just like a couple jokes to kind of hold the rest of the story together.
It's definitely slight, but I laughed a lot.
Yeah, well, man, like I said, I enjoyed it at the time, but I feel like it's I guess I wanted something like, you know, 22 Jump Street, like clever funny. I wanted more Lego Movie kind of fun and funny. Like, I don't know. Maybe it's just I was too busy like feeling the weight of all the grief from all the other films that I couldn't stop and focus. Because I did watch Nice Guys a couple times and I enjoyed it every time. But I guess I enjoyed it more every time I watched it.
I mean, go ahead, Gene. Sorry.
Well, I was just going to say on comedies, one thing that I have been feeling in the last few years, and based on the ones you guys are saying that you were liking. I may be alone in this among us, but I feel like any more comedies, if it's strictly a comedy, is almost always R-rated and is almost always filled with just crude humor and asking you to laugh just because they're saying the F word a bunch or just because whatever humor it is they're doing is with some sort of sexual undertone or just completely outright sexually flamboyant. And I just am not, I'm not into that kind of humor. That strikes me as kind of lowbrow, and I'm not, I don't know.
Lazy.
I'm just not.
Yeah. It's super lazy.
It can be very lazy, and I'm just not interested. Like if I see a trailer for a comedy and I see that it's R rated, just in my mind, I'm just right away thinking, well, I'm probably not going to see that.
Pass.
And if I do, it'll be a red box, and more than likely I'll turn it off after half an hour.
Well,
except for 21 Jump Street, right?
No, I did watch all of that. I did watch all of that.
But that's the thing.
And
so,
there's some that only touch on those kinds of those more crude elements that I'm not too thrilled about. But there's some that just dive right into them and just spend the whole movie in them, and it's just like, okay, I get it.
Mm-hmm. Well, so. I mean, that's the thing. I feel like there are a couple different categories of comedies, and I think the kind of like the raunchy comedy, this is like movies that I think aren't necessarily bad ideas for comedies. They just are executed like very lazily, and they end up, like you say, Gene, this is what Mike and Dave Need Wedding Dates. This was definitely Neighbors 2.
So sad.
Yeah. After Neighbors 1 was kind of surprisingly funny and endearing, Neighbors 2 was a phone in. You know, where I guess when I lament that I did not see another What We Do in the Shadows. Or something like that. I lament.
Didn't you see Mascots?
I did, and it was not very good.
Oh,
yeah,
that's too bad.
I turned that one off.
Yeah, I think we got about halfway through, and I was like, "There's understated comedy, and then there's like, come on, like, give me something."
Yeah, it just wasn't very funny.
But there was like, so I watched Sausage Party, and Sausage Party actually is. I think it actually fits under what you're talking about with faith-based films stepping up their game, Aaron.
What?
And I think
I know where you're going with this, and I want to hear it.
Give it to me. No, because Sausage Party is basically all the subtlety and nuance and argument of God's Not Dead, except it has funny jokes instead of like predictable, hollow, like not even two-dimensional characters, like one-dimensional characters. So it's like there are parts in Sausage Party that are hilariously clever, but it keeps coming back to beat this like atheism, anti-faith message, to evangelize it so hard that the movie ends up being a message film more than it is an actual comedy, which is unfortunate. Cause like I said, there was lots of, puns and food humor there. But then, like I said, lots of it's crude and stuff like that. And if certain things don't bother you, I would really think it would make a great conversation piece because of its particular perspective and apologetics or anti-apologetics. Just to give a shout out, I know the guys at More Than One Lesson talked about it, or at least Tyler wrote about it. I can't remember if they did a podcast too, but I know he wrote about it, and it kind of sums up a lot of it, kind of how it's almost good, but then it just takes that message film turn. So like, I feel like that's the best we got. Like one of the best possible comedies is really just like an anti-faith based film. It just disappointed me. That's why I said Popstar. That's why I think Popstar was in my top 10 this year, because it was insanely clever. It only once or twice took that turn towards like cheap laugh or inappropriate thing. You know, obviously plenty of language, because of the, you know, being in the almost mockumentary, like more outrageous kind of Spinal Tap world that it was in. But I just wanted something super funny. I mean, I just wanted to laugh. I was so tired of crying all the time.
I'll have to give that one a shot then.
Did you not try to watch Brooklyn Nine-Nine or?
Oh, you no, mean... I didn't. I didn't. I didn't watch that one.
That makes me laugh.
Oh, Brooklyn Nine-Nine is probably the funniest show on TV right now. I'm trying to think of anything that would. No, I think it's probably the funniest show on TV. It has filled a large void left by shows like Parks and Rec and 30 Rock and stuff like that.
Yeah, shoot. Even with This Is Us, our TV shows made us cry. What the heck, man?
Yeah, I'm like weeping every single episode of This Is Us. I'm waiting for it to be. Anyway, doesn't matter. We're not talking about TV shows right now. That would be our Emmy preview show. This is our now shifting to Oscar preview. So, for our Oscar preview part of the show, we will kind of give our opinions on a few of the major categories because we don't really have time to go through every single category. And I think it'll give us a chance to talk a lot more about what we liked and disliked about 2016. And we can also talk about what we liked and disliked about, you know, how the Academy chooses people or movies for things. So we are just going to, we're going to start with supporting actor. And for 2016, or I guess it's technically the 2017 nomination, for best supporting actor included Michael Shannon from Nocturnal Animals, Mahershala Ali from Moonlight, Jeff Bridges from Hell or High Water, Dev Patel from Lion, and Lucas Hedges from Manchester by the Sea. So what I'm curious about is who is your pick from these people, from these options, and would that also be your pick for the year? And then kind of why? So, JR, let's start with you. Best supporting actor, who do you have in your Oscar pool, and is that the same person that you would have otherwise?
Yeah, mine is Mahershala Ali from Moonlight. And I don't know if you can like super appreciate his performance there unless you've seen him in like the seven other things he's been in the last few years.
He was in everything last year.
He was everything. Yeah.
He kept popping up. He was in Hidden Figures. I was like, whoa.
Yeah. There, buddy. I mean, he was just phenomenal in Moonlight. I love Jeff Bridges and Michael Shannon, but they basically played the exact same character, like as each other, which was fine. I didn't get to see Lion yet. It's still on my list. And I thought the kid from Manchester did fine. But good. Like he did a great job. I loved Manchester by the Sea, but I don't know. I was transfixed by all of the acting in Moonlight, but particularly Ali. Yeah. So I would love to see him win just because I would love to see that actor getting some more recognition. Mm-hmm. And I think he's great in every single thing he does. And I don't think giving it, I don't think there's a bad pick in this category. But yeah, Ali is it for
me. Never mind.
I didn't see Lion. So maybe.
Yeah, I was going to say, Dev Patel did nothing for me in Lion.
Okay.
Law. Yeah, I agree.
So
I guess there's a bad pick, but it's not Ali.
So Aaron, how about you? Best supporting actor?
Well, my top two picks are not nominated, unfortunately, and that would be John Goodman and Ben Foster. Mm-hmm. So those guys, I think, I felt were both winners of this category, and so it was really sad not to see them nominated. I mean, I love Jeff Bridges, but I really wish that spot would have gone to Ben Foster.
Oh, yeah, easily.
I'm a Ben Foster fan. I've loved him in every single thing he's been in.
Especially Warcraft.
Except that, which is what I was going to say. Other than that, that just did not work for me. But not the movie. The movie worked fine. You and I got to talk about that one, too. But it was a good movie, but not him in the movie. But, yeah, so John Goodman, as we mentioned already, major snub. Just I don't know. These early films, it's so unfortunate. I mean, because – Tin Cloverfield Lane came out in either late January or early February. And it really hurts movies. You know, it just kind of got forgotten about.
Well, it helps them. It tends to help them if they're good. It helps them at the box office.
True. Well, but yeah, ones that have more staying power.
Yeah, it doesn't really do them any favors come awards time.
Awards season. Yeah, they're out of sight, out of mind by that point. But so within this category, I will say it got a little closer last night after watching Nocturnal Animals. Michael Shannon was fantastic.
Right.
But it, like JR, it's a Mahershala Ali's award for me. I think hands down within this group.
Yeah.
I would be shocked if he doesn't win it, and I'd actually be a little upset, to be honest. And I don't think that he needs to get it to combat the Oscar so white mentality. But this year we have amazing performances by actors of color that are absolutely worth these awards going to.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope that that's recognized. So yeah, I think it's an upset if Ali doesn't win this.
I can say it's tough though too, because I mean, just body of work wise, it's about time Michael Shannon wins one, right?
It is. Yeah. I mean, it's absolutely, I mean, he's done so much great work his whole career, but yeah, not for movie, it's gotta be Ali.
I think Ali almost caught up to Shannon just in the last 2 years.
Well, it's because he was in everything over the last
two
years.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah, like.
So, who's left? Who's left? Let's see. Goose wet paper.
Goose and Barker.
I
think this category is one I've seen the least amount of these movies. I've only seen two of them, Hell or High Water and Manchester. And I'm very much with JR on Lucas Hedges in Manchester. Mm-hmm. He was pretty good. And there was one particular scene where he's reflecting on something that they want to do with his dead father's body. They want to freeze it. And there's a particular scene, JR, I think you even pointed it out on the podcast that we did on this one, where he just kind of breaks down and he's opening the freezer in his own home and it just like suddenly breaks down. And I thought he was very good in that moment. But otherwise, he was just pretty good. He was playing like a teenager. It didn't seem like a particularly difficult role to pull off. I think in terms of performances of what I've seen, I would pick Jeff Bridges in this. But even then, again, it's not one I'm super thrilled about. I wasn't nearly as high on Hell or High Water as everyone else was. But Jeff Bridges was pretty good, but it was like a Jeff Bridges role, mm-hmm. you know?
Can we give the best supporting actress to that old lady at the steakhouse in Hell or High Water?
You know what? I've got a funny, interesting thing about that. You know, all the comparisons between Hell or High Water kind of come back to No Country for Old Men.
Yes.
She is in No Country for Old Men.
Oh, that's awesome.
She is at the motel where he checks in.
Nice.
She's on the run. She's the person that checks him into the motel.
She's at the desk.
She's at the desk and she makes some witty. She's literally the same exact character, and I just thought that was a brilliant casting move.
Oh,
so subtly to do that.
Oh,
that's cool. You know that feeling though you get when you're pretty familiar with an actor and their abilities, and by sheer virtue of the fact that everyone is speaking so highly of them, you almost want to just say, "Yeah, I would go with Mahershala Ali." Even though I haven't even seen the movie, because I feel so confident that because of what everyone is saying and because of things I've seen him in and I know how well he does already, that he probably did knock it out of the park. I just haven't got a chance to see it. So it's almost like just my anticipation of wanting to see him work in that outweighs my strong feelings or mediocre feelings towards Jeff Bridges.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, there's that.
Yeah. So, for me, I think from the people nominated, like I was very surprised at this category. I feel like they picked a whole lot of the right movies, but the wrong people. and in the category, I think Mahershala Ali is probably going to win it. It's hard for me to believe anyone but him's going to win it. But I still had a problem with him, which was, maybe I'm falling into the trap of best being most, but he was in the film for such a short amount of time, I was actually a little upset after hearing how great he was in it. Because I was like, yeah, he was great, but I've seen him in seven other things, and he was great in all these things. Like, where was the part where he just destroyed it? So he was great the whole time, but he never had, I thought, one or two, like, just... like, scene-stealing kind of things. Like, we're talking about, like, Lucas had in Manchester by the Sea, even though Lucas, obviously, you know, was kind of mediocre the rest of the time, and had the one scene, like... You know, Jeff Bridges has that one scene at the very end of Hell and High Water that just had me on the edge of my seat. But the rest of it, he's just kind of Jeff Bridges. Michael Shannon has one or two places in Nocturnal Animals where you were like, he just escalated the Michael Shannon game. But for the rest of the time, he's just kind of Michael Shannon's kind of weird, kind of creepy, aloof character. And I feel like Mahershala Ali never had that moment for me.
Oh man, the dinner table for me when he brings him to the table and they're having that conversation, and he says, you know, what's a faggot? Is what he asks him,
mm-hmm.
And every bit of Mahershala Ali's facial expressions and gestures his acting in that moment to me is all we needed.
That was your moment?
Personally. That was my moment for him by far.
So even with that complaint, I want to try to make sure that that complaint is in perspective. I still think he has this category wrapped up. I think that the thing for me is that if you put Ben Foster from Hell or High Water in this category, then I take Ben Foster every day, because I think without Ben Foster, Hell or High Water loses almost all of its punch. So,
I would also, just for posterity, I'd like to point out that Anthony Hopkins won Best Supporting Actor for Silence of the Lambs, and he's in it for, like, I think, what is it, like 10 minutes total or something like that?
Yeah, and that's one thing that I typically want to argue against, because it's kind of like this is really prevalent in, like, the special effects and the categories like that, where it's not the best special effects, it's the most special effects. This occasionally happens in the acting categories, where you have someone who's up for a supporting actor, but they're in the film for like 10 minutes. And someone else who's a supporting actor who's in the film for like 45 minutes, they win. Because people are like, well, they were obviously better because there was more of them. So I want to avoid that entrapment, but...
But this time you're not.
But I feel like it mattered to me this time. But again, with all that said, I still find that to be a minor complaint. And of the choices, Mahershala Ali, hands down. So I think we all we're counting Gene as a probably would be there too kind of vote. And I think we're all on the same page in this one. So moving on to our next category, Best Supporting Actress. We have Naomi Harris from Moonlight. We have Michelle Williams from Manchester by the Sea. We have Viola Davis from Fences, Octavia Spencer from Hidden Figures, and Nicole Kidman from Lion. So who did I start with last time? JR?
Me.
So Gene, you went last. Now you get to go first. The first shall be last, right? Wait, the last shall be first. There you go. Who you got in Best Actress?
Let me get this out here. I will fight any of you if you do not vote for Viola Davis in this category.
I'll bite you.
I'm with you. She smoked it. This is one of the moments that I was crying. And this is a weird time for me to cry. Like most movies, to make me cry, there needs to be some kind of a really strong father-son connection. That's typically my trigger, okay? And... There was a father-son connection in this movie, but that's not what got me crying. It was when Viola went on her monologue and she is like slobber sobbing and pouring her heart out to Denzel's character. And it was amazing. I was tearing up and I was crying. It was incredibly impactful. I will remember that moment in that film for a long time. And her role in the rest of the movie is very much... it kind of defines the word supportive. I feel like both supportive of her husband, and just as a character in general. So I thought Viola Davis completely killed this role. It was terrific.
Gotcha. So Aaron, how about you? Are you going to fight Gene?
Are you going to get no. fault? No, I'm going to stand behind him and give him water for his fight, because I completely agree. I think that Viola Davis was hands down, I mean, the best. And I understand the love for Michelle Williams, but for me, Michelle Williams, my problem with her performance is actually very similar to your concern about Mahershala Ali. I mean, she's just not in the movie. She's not the main character. she's very much there to be there for one real big, brilliant moment. Mm-hmm. And it's a big, brilliant moment, but when you put that up against what Viola Davis accomplished in a feature length film, where she very well could have been a lead, to be honest. It doesn't even come close. I thought Nicole Kidman's inclusion in this was just a joke.
Really?
To be honest, it didn't work for me. I think emotionally, I understand the draw of what her character went through and was, raising a son and not knowing whether he was going to go away and come back or what. But I didn't love it. I thought Octavia Spencer was the third best. I thought they were all good, but I thought she was the third best of the three performances in Hidden Figures.
Yeah.
I thought Taraji Henson was just phenomenal.
I agree.
And I think Janelle Monáe is going to be a superstar, to be honest. So, I thought I love Octavia, but I just thought, whatever. To me, this is the most locked category of the entire show.
So here's my thing.
Don't you dare.
And
this is the moment Mikey stops being friends with Gene. Here it is, folks.
Wait, we're still friends? I'm so happy. I do not
look at you stumbling for words.
I do not disagree with the reasoning behind people throwing their full support behind Viola Davis. However,
but you do.
This is the difference between Michelle Williams and Mahershala Ali for me. This is why I was trying to be very specific about my very slight criticism about Ali. For me, there was never a moment where Mahershala Ali made the film. I feel like without the scene that Michelle Williams nails in Manchester by the Sea, that film does not hit me as hard when Casey Affleck's character finally breaks down. That scene was so pivotal to everything that happened. And if that scene wouldn't have been done just right, if Michelle Williams wouldn't have given it everything she did, even though she's not in it a lot, again, very similar to Ali, I feel like she had the great moment that I didn't get with Ali in Moonlight. So even though she's not in it a lot, for me, this is me picking, all things equal, I'm picking Michelle Williams as someone who did not act a lot, but when she was there, she did it. And I'm not going to let a great performance by Viola Davis, just because she's there more, sway me. So
you're saying that the one scene by Michelle Williams was more powerful than the most powerful scenes by Viola Davis?
I think
for you,
for me,
obviously,
I think Manchester by the Sea does not hit me as hard as it does without the scene that one scene from Michelle Williams being nailed like 100%. Fences is obviously better because Viola Davis is in it all through it.
I would say like what the end of that film means, isn't the same if that same scene that Gene was referencing in Fences is just pretty good. Like, you needed her rage and her grief to explode against him, because he has been such a such a big presence the whole film. Like even that opening scene,
yeah,
where he's not even listening to anyone else. He's just talking at his wife and his friend, and they're like his audience. And that's right. That's how he is throughout the whole film until that scene. And that fundamentally changes something for the rest of the film. And then of course, when you get to the end and he's gone and you just have all of these people that are sort of like living around the crater that he's left in their midst. I don't know, like that for me, that did have that same effect.
Mm. So since I didn't get to ask you yet, I'm guessing you're going with Viola Davis.
Yeah. I mean, listen, I loved that moment from Michelle Williams, mm-hmm. but I'm going to actually kind of pull a page from your book in the last category, Mikey. For me, she and Viola both deliver comparable moments, and Viola was in more of the rest of the film at a similarly excellent level.
Yeah.
So, like, for me, those two, even if you cancel those two things out, you have the rest of the film where Viola's much more
still crushing
present.
It, yeah.
You know, yeah. I would be a little sad to see Michelle Williams win, but I would get it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I can imagine this just being a difference of opinion. Like, okay, sure, they're two great performances. I haven't seen Lion.
No.
I haven't seen 20th Century Women. I liked Octavia Spencer in Hidden Figures. I don't like Aaron, I don't know how to have chosen her.
Yeah, same
as
here.
The nom.
Actually, I wanted to mention something really quick. I think Naomi Harris in Moonlight was pretty phenomenal too.
Agreed.
In 20th Century Women?
Or no, I copied and pasted that wrong. Naomi Harris is totally in Moonlight.
Oh, okay. Oh, is that his mom?
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh gosh, yeah, she is.
Yeah.
Especially when you contrast her to her Bond girl vibe.
Yeah, in that case I would see either Naomi Harris or Viola Davis. Yeah, she was incredible in Moonlight. Mm-hmm. And she had to be if you haven't seen Moonlight, it's three different chapters in the same boy's life. Mm-hmm. So she's three different people.
Yeah, very distinct.
And I mean, you always knew it was her, but she inhabited all three of those sort of moments really, really well.
Mm-hmm.
JR, I feel you drifting away from Viola Train.
No. Oh, so here's what I'm saying now. I'm on Viola, but if Naomi Harris took it, I wouldn't be mad.
Yeah. I feel like of all the categories, this one's the hardest probably for me. Usually I feel like best actor is probably the category that I have the hardest time with, because usually so many obviously great roles written for men.
Mikey thinks that men are better actors than women is what he just said, guys.
That's not what I said at all. Actually, I said, unfortunately, most of the roles that are great are written for men. So you usually have just a plethora more to choose from. It's kind of why the best actress category is usually a bunch of movies that no one's ever seen. Because it usually includes more foreign or independent films, because those are the ones that actually write for female lead characters, because it's sadly so rare. But in this case, supporting actress between Harris, Williams, and Davis, I feel like they chose the best three options. And Octavia Spencer, I agree that I think she was actually the third best performance in that film. And I actually personally, even though I didn't like Lion as much as many people, I thought Nicole Kidman was one of the highlights of the second half of the film. In a otherwise not very good second half of that film.
I was just going to ask, I remember you saying something about the second half really fell, you know, backwards a little bit. Do you think she held it up as much as
I think
it could have been?
I think the potential for her character was the only thing that brought any emotion to the second half of the film, outside of kind of, to use Joel Mayward's words, kind of manipulate the audience via the adoption narrative, which goes back to the best supporting actor. I think Dev Patel being nominated for Lion is kind of silly, because he didn't do anything but walk around and mope, and we didn't really have any reason to engage with his character. Now, the kid that's in the first half of the film that plays the younger version of Dev's character, if you wanted to throw an Oscar his way, I mean, up until that film switches gears to what would, I guess, be considered the present, it was basically the best foreign language film I've seen in years. And then it doesn't, this isn't a breakdown of Lion. This is why we're not covering Lion, because I don't want to bash it, because I know so many people are enjoying it. But I do think of the things in the second half of the film, Nicole Kidman is one of the only things that bring a lot of emotion to that film. Feel free to disagree with me. I don't think a lot of people do, though. So if Viola Davis takes Best Supporting Actress, I think everyone's here is fine with that, and Gene doesn't have to kill anybody. And I just wanted to make sure we had a chance to make a case for some of the other people, because I do think, like I said, Harris Williams and Davis all nailed it this year. So, goodness. See, I knew this would take a lot more time than I always think it does. So moving on to Best Actress. In the Best Actress category, the nominees by the Motion Picture Academy America were Emma Stone from La La Land. Isabel Huppert?
Huppert,
there you go. I figured it was foreign. From Elle, Ruth Negga from Loving, Meryl Streep from Florence Foster Jenkins, and Natalie Portman for Jackie. So, Aaron,
do you want to take a guess?
I would like you to explain why. Yeah, I have no idea. So, who would you pick? I mean...
I like JR's question, honestly, is explaining why.
Yeah.
So I absolutely am going to go Emma Stone, but, and this is the but here, I would not be upset at all if Natalie Portman won this award. I have been a Natalie Portman fan for years and years and years, going back to teenager. She was probably my first film actress crush. And I was not expecting to enjoy Jackie. I don't know how much I did enjoy Jackie, but I respect the heck out of that movie, and her performance is incredible. I mean, it is a home run in every sense of the word. So it would not bother me one bit if she walked out the door with a statue. However, for me, because of my connection to La La Land,
your personal connection.
Yeah, that's what I'm just, you know, framing it honestly. It's because of that. You know, it's a film that has, you know, won me over big time. And I thought that Emma Stone made the movie. Now, my reasons for choosing her are because I think that she pulls off quite a few different beats very well. I think she handles comedy in La La Land flawlessly. I grin and I smile and I laugh at everything that she does, every little joke, every subtlety. And then really her performance for me, we talk about moments. Her performance is made by the dinner table scene with Ryan Gosling, where they start off and they're just having a nice dinner. It's kind of a surprise. Things are going well. It's a nice thing. And it is one of the most awesome scenes in cinema for me last year, because it just... it feels so real as you sit down and you have this dinner together and everything's hunky dory, but you have these underlying problems. This is any husband and wife or relationship. And slowly but surely those things start to come out. And we get to this moment where the camera is fixated on Emma's face and she's just giving these facial expressions that are awesome to me. I mean, I think she sells it so well. Her pain and her frustration and her confusion with him and his actions. And I love that. And then you take, you know, it forward to her big moment when she sings her song Audition. I know I've read up on the history of that being, you know, her actually doing that with the piano lagging behind her and having to sing that for the cameras live. And I think that she nails it for me in so many different aspects in this film that I really want to see her win an award for this.
Mm. So, JR.
Yeah.
How do you feel about the actress category?
So I haven't seen any of these movies except for La La Land. And I don't know. I thought Emma Stone was. I felt like I liked both of them more in Crazy Stupid Love than I did in La La Land. Like they were fine. It was a fine. Like it was fine. But I can't imagine.
Just gonna go on mute real quick.
Enjoy any of these other movies, and particularly performances. Like you can't tell me Streep didn't do a better job. It's Meryl. And again, I've heard nothing.
You mean
but...
Meryl Streep, the most overrated actress in all of history?
Yeah, that one. Yep. And then again, Natalie Portman. I've heard nothing but good. So I'm gonna have to just go off of what I've heard in this one and say I don't really have a dog in this fight. I don't know. I don't particularly care. I don't have really strong feelings about it in any direction. I like Emma Stone, so if she took home a statue, it'd be fine. I really am still struggling to figure out what everyone liked about La La Land so much, because I thought it was just fine.
That's what we can talk about after the show.
I thought Hail Caesar was a much more interesting homage to old Hollywood. So.
Gotcha. And that's fair. Like I said, so this is one of the hardest things about Oscar predictions, because lots of times you find the movies that like, one that all came out at the very end of the year all together, and you're like, of course I didn't see all these films because none of them came out to where normal people could see them. I would literally have to be in the Academy and get screeners to watch most of the stuff. Gene, how many of these did you see?
I saw a couple of them. You know, on Jackie, I didn't see that, and man, just from the trailers, I didn't feel like there was a whole lot there for Natalie Portman to do necessarily. I may be completely wrong about that, but most of what I heard has been good, not great, or pretty good, not super great, kind of that kind of thing. Nothing bad or anything like that. But I think for me, it comes down between Emma Stone and Meryl Streep. And for me, I think I go Meryl Streep.
Oh.
Well, so let me say this.
I just heard Aaron's heart.
Quite literally, like my next to worst favorite movie of the year, or least favorite movie of the year.
Yeah, I know you said that. And I mean, you can be wrong. That's fine.
Well, I think that's an interesting point, because that's how I would classify Ruth Negga's performance. Like, I think she did a perfectly fine job in a movie that I thought was fairly uninteresting and not very well done. Or it told a story that was not very interesting. Which is unfortunate, because I was really looking forward to Loving. And I think by trying to make it too everyday, average, real to life, they actually took most of the drama out of it. And so what Ruth Negga ended up doing was just kind of going from scene to scene, being the best character she could be, doing not a whole lot, except for just kind of looking around being like, well, that's unfortunate. That's unfortunate. So even though I didn't like Loving, I still am like, well, I mean, Ruth did as good a job as anybody else, I guess. And I didn't get to see Florence Foster Jenkins. And I'm actually curious. I don't think anyone saw Elle, right? Because it's basically been...
No,
I'm going to try to catch it before the Oscars. I mean, she won the Golden Globe.
Yeah, I'm going to say she won the Golden Globe. And from all I can tell, everything that I can tell, I think if we would have seen Elle, we might be on the, you know, Isabel Huppert train. Maybe except for Aaron.
I'm open to it.
But I like Natalie Portman a lot. The wife and I sat down to watch Jackie. We got about halfway through it and we were like, you ready to go to bed? Yeah, I'm ready to go to bed. It was kind of boring. She was doing a fine job. But I wasn't blown away by her performance so much that it was keeping me interested in otherwise not exceptionally exciting film that I think was not supposed to be exceptionally exciting. So I think if I had to pick for an Oscar pool, I would probably put my money on Isabel Huppert, but of what I've seen, Emma Stone, I thought, did a pretty great job. And I don't want to belittle the actresses by pointing this out. I wish it would challenge Hollywood. I think when I see Emma Stone and Ruth Negga and Natalie Portman, and then I feel like a token nomination for Meryl Streep, just because it's like you're contractually obligated to nominate Meryl Streep if she acts in a movie. I feel like this is a category that is weak because there's not a lot of great roles for leading actresses, and that makes me sad.
I get what you're saying there about sort of the default nomination for an actress of Meryl Streep's caliber, but I really think she earned it with this, because I feel like what she was asked to pull off mm-hmm. with Florence Foster Jenkins was like a greater degree of difficulty than an Emma Stone yeah. was doing. So, and I don't mean to demean like any of the dancing or the singing. I know that's all difficult, but I feel like with Florence Foster Jenkins, Meryl Streep had to walk such a fine line between ridiculous and overdoing it, and strike such a specific chord with this performance. And I feel like she did it, because there were times where I was laughing at her character because it was so completely silly what she was doing. But then there were other times that I really felt compassion for her in the treatment that she was getting from other people. So I really think she pulled it off on this one.
So my criticism isn't indicative of her specific performance. It's indicative of the past couple of years. Like, I've seen her nominated for things that people are like, well, it definitely wasn't the best. And I think it's twofold. It's she gets a nomination because there's not a lot of competition. So even if she were to have an average performance for Meryl Streep, it would still be as good as any other opportunity anybody else is given, which I lament, because I typically see very few things. And I don't know why Amy Adams wasn't nominated in this category for Arrival. So
yeah, there's that. Amy Adams and Mary Elizabeth Winstead, I would say,
yeah,
as well.
Okay, so we were doing exactly what I thought we would do, which is definitely have too much to say. So we're going to try to speed it up just a little bit. And we'll be able to talk about some non-major category omissions right at the end in our final question. But so let's hit Best Actor pretty quickly. In Best Actor, we had Andrew Garfield for Hacksaw Ridge, Ryan Gosling for La La Land, Denzel Washington for Fences, Casey Affleck for Manchester by the Sea, and Viggo Mortensen for Captain Fantastic. JR, who do you got?
I want to pick Casey Affleck so badly, mm-hmm. but all of the abuse allegations that have come out around him have made me very uncomfortable with like endorsing him in any way. And I think it's particularly noteworthy that similar allegations pretty much completely train wrecked Nate Parker and Birth of a Nation, and they haven't touched Casey Affleck at all. Mm-hmm. So that makes me, can I give it to Andrew Garfield for Silence?
I know. I agree.
Well, I was going to say that I think that would be the consensus for me. I've said in more than one place that if you just take all the nominations for Hacksaw Ridge and replace it with the word Silence, I would just pick that for everything.
Honestly, out of this list, I wouldn't mind seeing Denzel take it home again. I didn't see Captain Fantastic, so. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, Viggo is great in Captain Fantastic, despite some of the issues I had with how Captain Fantastic ended, but he did. Yeah, he was great. All of them were great. I would actually, if you're going to throw Andrew Garfield, a switch for Hacksaw Ridge, I would actually point out, like I did in my top 10, that Ryan Gosling wasn't near as good in La La Land as he was in Nice Guys. If anything, he should have got a nomination for the Nice Guys, cause, he crushed it there. I would say if I had to pick it strictly on, no outside influence, I would say Casey Affleck would take it home. If that somehow does influence things, then even though he was kind of like a Denzel character that I've seen before, he still, I mean, we shouldn't punish Denzel for bringing his A game to everything. So I would go with Denzel. Mm-hmm. Gene, what about you?
I think I might go with a dark horse here and go with Viggo for Captain Fantastic. That's not a movie overall that I particularly liked, but I think that he was doing a terrific job as the father in that film. Second would be, I think, Ryan Gosling. And then I really think Denzel and Casey Affleck were doing superbly at things that they always do superbly at. So they're up there too. Garfield is a kind of a square peg in a round hole, I think, in this category for Hacksaw Ridge. Mm. I think maybe only half that movie is his performance necessarily worth being even considered for this category.
Yeah. Aaron?
You know, I loved Viggo as well, and I loved Garfield in Silence. I think my pick would once again be not nominated, which is Chris Pine for Hell or High Water. That was my favorite performance, I would say. Well, I'll take that back. That was my favorite performance. I don't know if it was the best. I would go with Denzel. I just think he's the powerhouse that we know he can be. And I don't think he should be punished for being...
For being awesome all the time.
Literally maybe the best actor of our generation. Yeah. I don't think that we should punish him for that. I think he should be rewarded.
Isn't that crazy? Like, basically, he's so good all the time. We're like, well, that's what I expected. So that didn't stand out for me.
Yeah, it's very similar to the Meryl Streep argument. Yeah. Because though I hate that film, I will agree with Gene. I will agree with Gene. She makes me hate it because she's so good at the role.
Yeah.
So I will agree that she's a great performance in the movie. I just hate it and can't get behind it.
All right. So we move on to Best Director. This is where it starts getting interesting. In Best Director, we have a nomination for Mel Gibson for Hacksaw Ridge, Barry Jenkins for Moonlight, Kenneth Lonergan for A Monster Calls, Denis Villeneuve for Arrival, and Damien Chazelle for La La Land. Gene, who do you have?
Well, let me point out we have a typo there. Kenneth Lonergan was Manchester by the Sea. I think Monster Calls was J.A. Boyana.
Oh, dang it. See, why didn't you tell me that before?
I would have had to read your email beforehand.
Oh, gosh.
Eggers. So is it Manchester or Monster Calls that's up?
It's Manchester.
Yeah. That makes way more sense to me.
So, let's see. Best director, then. I'm going to go with Damien Chazelle simply because of the intricate camera work and scenery that he was weaving through the whole film. If that was Monster Calls, I think I'd go with J.A. Boyana because I think the work that he did with McDougal, I think is the boy's name. I think the work he did with him in that film is amazing. But out of these, I think I would certainly say Damien Chazelle with a small asterisk and Whiplash callbacks.
Gotcha. Like the Academy Award he should have won for Whiplash. Aaron, same question.
Damien Chazelle, all the same reasons that Gene mentioned. I think this is an incredibly strong category. I'm pretty sure I know which direction you're going to go, Mikey, and I will not be upset if that happens.
Hacksaw Ridge is so good, man.
I'm pretty sure you're not going to pick that. You know, Martin Scorsese did a fantastic job as always, and the one that's really lacking here, I think, that could replace Gibson also is Park Chan-wook. I don't know if I'm the only one that's seen The Handmaiden, but that's an amazing, amazing film.
I don't watch pornography.
Nice.
I mean, yeah. I haven't watched it fast. Yet.
What are you doing here? So yeah, Damien Chazelle for me. I think it was a masterwork of directing. Mm-hmm. You know, regardless of what you may think about the overall feeling of the film.
No, so JR.
Yeah, I'd probably pick Kenneth Lonergan. I just thought that was such a tremendous film, and I thought it looked exactly like it needed to look, you know, to capture what was happening and what was being said. And so
his choice of how to order the scenes in that film was a really terrific choice.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was interesting. And yeah. And then again, if Barry Jenkins takes it home from Moonlight, I will not complain. I will actually do a little dance. That was an interesting way to tell a story, and a lot of the shots, like the way he conveyed intimacy and alienation, I thought was really interesting with the camera. So,
yeah.
I actually said the same thing on Twitter, JR. I commented on a tweet that said the same thing. I said, well, my pick would be La La Land, but I would be happy and clap for Barry Jenkins if he gets it. And he liked my tweet. So
yes! Oh, that's awesome.
Barry and I are tight.
You're Mr. Jenkins, you're best friends. Friends. Love to have you on the show. I just have to say, I do not understand why Hacksaw Ridge is getting any awards, particularly for directing. That film was a complete dumpster fire of tone and pacing. Like, I went into it expecting it to be amazing because I'd heard it gotten all these standing ovations at critics circles, yeah, and all this kind of stuff. And when the credits rolled, I was like, what was that? Like, it was at best a B minus.
I would agree with that on Best Picture. Like, I don't think it belongs in there, but you think even with directing, you don't think Gibson deserves a nomination there?
No. I mean, for me, direction is, did you accomplish it? Like, did you bring the vision across the finish line? This felt to me like a sloppy second draft.
Mm. Okay.
Well, I do think, again, if we were to replace Hacksaw Ridge with Silence, Scorsese, in a field that is so strong, I think the hardest, I want to say every category is the hardest now, that, like, I can't, it's hard for me to pick a best director, again, if you replace Mel Gibson with Scorsese, but I would probably go with Scorsese. In this case, I actually do appreciate Damien Chazelle for all the things that he did in La La Land and kind of want him to win because he should get the Oscar for the Whiplash, for the one he should have won for Whiplash.
You want a Michael Caine him, I see.
Yeah. But. I mean, because some of the things that he did in La La Land were so great. Like La La Land was one of only two movies this year that I saw where I sat there and I said, this is why I'm not an Academy Award director, because I would have never thought to do that. And it was amazing. And one of those was Damien Chazelle in La La Land. And the other was Denis Villeneuve in Arrival. And I think it is so incredibly hard to make a heady sci-fi film that is also, like, emotionally powerful and culturally relevant. And he made a film that I think was superb in tone, in, like, visually, the performances we got. So I can't do anything but hope that he takes an award home, even though I know he's going to lose to Damien Chazelle. So that would be my pick, but I understand. All right, so our final category, and I think we've talked about most of these films enough that we can probably go through this one pretty quick, but the penultimate category, Best Picture, JR, who do you got?
I would love to see Moonlight win it this year. I think La La Land is going to win it, but I think I would love to see Moonlight win it.
Is it even close for you?
What do you mean, is it even close?
Like, is there anything that would be, like, you would think would be deserving besides Moonlight on this list?
Oh, Manchester would also, another one. Manchester or Moonlight, either one.
Okay.
I mean, I would love to see Arrival win it because it's a sci-fi film.
Yeah.
And that would be, like, the best.
Right.
But I'm not holding my breath.
Yeah.
I'm actually not holding my breath to anything except La La Land's going to win it, and that's stupid, but whatever.
Hey, Aaron, so what do you feel about Best Picture?
You know, I really liked Hidden Figures. No. I can't say that. I mean, La La Land's, I've proclaimed this, that it is now my favorite movie of all time, and it would be remiss if I didn't say I think it should be the best picture of this year. So, yeah. Obviously, that's my choice. If it doesn't win, because I don't think a best picture Oscar means anything to my love of the film,
yeah,
I won't hate it at all if Arrival wins. I love Denis Villeneuve. I'm a sci-fi geek, and like you, this film blew me away.
Yeah.
Hell or High Water was my second favorite film of the year, though. I don't think it has a chance. Moonlight, I'm not going to be upset because I love the movie. Manchester, a little bit less for me. But yeah, it's all about La La Land for me. It just is everything the connections have made. And, you know, it's too bad we can't just give it to Mad Max Fury Road for JR.
Yeah.
Here we go.
You mean for everybody.
Amazing. it should just win every year until a better Mad Max film comes out. Which will probably be
All right, Gene, what did you think?
I'm going to go with Arrival. I would just copy everything you said about Denis Villeneuve for director and just paste it right here in Best Picture. I think he pulls together a perfect compilation of everything that a film should be. I think it has an amazing level of intrigue and mystery. It's got some terrific misdirection. And then I think it makes the audience really think about some significant issues by the end of the film. So I would go Arrival. And this category is interesting because more than any other, I feel like there are a few that I don't know if they even belong in this category.
Oh, yeah.
I think Hacksaw Ridge does not belong in Best Picture. I think Hidden Figures does not. I thought it was good, but not Best Picture worthy. Personally, and I'm probably alone here, I don't think Hell or High Water belongs in this category. From what I've heard of Lion, it feels like it doesn't necessarily belong. I feel like there's two or three kind of top dog contenders, and I feel like it's going to come down between La La Land and Arrival. I hope, anyways.
I would say that it's probably going to come down between La La Land, Moonlight, and Manchester. I think those are the ones that are getting the most buzz. If I had to pick, I would say that La La Land's probably going to win, but my problem with La La Land, as much as I enjoyed almost all of it and as much as I love Chazelle, I feel like it would win mostly for the fact that it kind of almost panders to its own audience, to the voters. I mean, like they're like the self-interest in reminiscing about this thing that they already love. Which again, I don't want it to sound too much of a criticism because I really did enjoy the movie, but I hope Arrival wins only because again, Silence isn't on this list for some kind of travesty. Silence is by far the best picture that I saw all year. Arrival, was right behind it. And honestly, if I had to choose between a movie that I watched repeatedly, I would probably watch Hell or High Water, but again, before I watched La La Land.
Really?
Yeah, I really liked Hell or High Water. It gets better every time I see it.
Yes.
I mean, when you talk about things that you can just talk about forever, I think Hell or High Water, it just really does it. So, like I said, I think La La Land's going to take it. I would love to see Arrival, but I don't even think Arrival is going to be considered. I think it's just a really well-done movie and that the Academy never knows what to do with sci-fi films. So, all right. So we have two final questions, and I think we can get through them pretty quickly. Each of you, give me some non-major category. We're talking about, like, best song, cinematography, whatever, that you'd just like to highlight. And this can be somebody that you just are excited that they're going to win. Being nominated or have an Oscar, or that you're really kind of upset that they were omitted. Gene.
It is a travesty in every sense of the word that Suicide Squad has the same number of nominations that Silence does.
Agreed.
That is so wrong. I can't even describe it. I mean,
breaks my
what
heart.
Are they, what is even happening? What is
breaking
going
my
on?
Heart.
So that's one thing I'd say.
JR, what else did you notice from the rest of the categories?
I'm really excited to see who wins Best Animated. I think it was a really strong category this year. I didn't see My Life as Zucchini or The Red Turtle, but the other three, Zootopia and Moana and Kubo, I was underwhelmed by Kubo, but the animation was phenomenal.
It was amazing.
And again, Moana... We talked about it on the episode. I got to be on The Real World for Moana. Like, that did some stuff with animation I've just never seen before, mixing styles and things like that. And then Zootopia was just dense and gorgeous world building. It was so creative and so detailed, and there were so many sight gags. It was a tremendous joy to watch. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I'm excited to see what wins in that category.
Yeah, and amazingly, I think that I'm glad you pointed that out, because like one of the first times that Pixar did not get nominated.
Yeah, well, I was just wondering if anyone was surprised that Finding Dory didn't get in there.
Yeah.
Having sat through that movie and managed barely to stay awake, yeah. I'm not at all surprised.
Yeah, I'm not personally surprised. After seeing the movie, I'm surprised just because of typically it's almost automatic. I guess,
yeah, since Brave it, and yeah. that movie was a train wreck.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
All right, Aaron.
Yeah, Kubo was one I would mention. It was one of my favorite animated films in years. I really, really am pulling for Hell or High Water to win original screenplay, yes, over La La Land.
Oh, yeah.
For me, the other thing, Drive It Like You Stole It, I don't know why Sing Street couldn't at least get a song nomination there. I felt that was just a bad, bad loss. Mm-hmm. It should have been in there. But for me, the documentary category is the other one. This year, I think I've watched more documentaries than I have in the past, and I think this is an incredibly strong field. It's even missing two of the best ones of the year, Gleason and Tower. If anybody's interested, check those out because they're phenomenal. I mean, this year in docs was wonderful, and the nominees are pretty much all great. I think O.J. Made in America is a standout film. I think 13th is wonderful. Life Animated is pretty special. So I love the documentary category this year, and that's never happened to me before.
Mm-hmm. So I would say that it kind of bums me out that Deadpool wasn't nominated for Best Picture, especially considering some of the things that were nominated for Best Picture.
it was never getting that nomination. Let's be honest.
I think that's a travesty. I think it sets out and does exactly what it meant to do. It not being nominated is almost on the same level as Silence not being nominated for Best Picture.
And ostensibly the whole reason, so they moved from 5 to up to 10
yeah.
the year after The Dark Knight was snubbed. And it was specifically because the Academy felt like only 5 nominations kept out some films that were truly excellent and non-typical Best Picture. But now you see the last 2 or 3 years, it's just like more less good typical Best Picture nomination.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. So, yeah, I mean, the reason they blew it out was for films like Deadpool.
Yeah. And that's the thing. So I see this across a couple things too. I would agree with Sing Street in the original song category. I would actually say that if we can nominate Everything Is Awesome, which we should have and did and should have won an award for, we should have been able to nominate songs from Popstar because some of those songs were great. And again, going with my Oscar theme of right movie, wrong actor, I think that Aaron Taylor Johnson was amazing in Nocturnal Animals, especially after seeing him in like Age of Ultron and seeing what he did in Nocturnal Animals. That to me shows range and blew me away. And
oh yeah,
again, generally the omission of Silence seems baffling to me for all the reasons. So mm-hmm.
can I say, like, I think one of the things I really noticed it this year is, you know, put yourself in the shoes of the Academy voters. Like, you've got a giant stack of screeners, and it's like, what do I want to watch? A 2-hour and 45-minute long movie about torturing Christians. A 2-hour long movie about a gay black kid that gets bullied, or a musical about young love. Like,
that will make me feel wonderful.
Yeah, I mean, like that, you know, so I just understand why some of these films that are more difficult don't get as much attention.
Mm-hmm.
Because at the end of the day, to get the vote, you have to get the views. And,
nope, you know, I agree. That's why I'm baffled maybe not baffled. I'm just frustrated that, you know, every year I'm like, it'll be different next year. It'll be different next year, but it's not ever different. Which is why I wanted to make sure that we had a chance to talk about what we would actually choose based on what we've seen, because I really don't
think we should start an Oscars So Serious campaign.
Oscars So Serious. Oscar Too Serious.
Yeah.
Well, actually, so that kind of can tie into our final thought. All right. The last thing, guys. JR, what would you say your least favorite film of 2016 is? And how do you think 2016 will be remembered?
2016 will be remembered as it'll probably be remembered as the year the superhero bubble burst. We had so many disappointing superhero films this year. Even with a couple of bright spots overall, most of them did not do great.
I think if we could get DC to stop weighing into that category, then...
Yeah, because even Fox went 50-50, right?
Yeah,
that's right.
Right. My least favorite film that I had to sit through this year was by far Suicide Squad. I actually saw it twice because I had a buddy who was out of town when it came out. And by the time he came back in town, no one would go see it with him. And so I took one for the team and went and saw it with him. And when it was over, he looked at me and he was like, it was as bad as you said it
was. He's like, why didn't you tell me? I did tell him.
And he was like, it was like, I was worried because sometimes I'm more critical than a lot of my friends of films. Mm-hmm. And when it got over, he looked at me and he was just like that was abominable.
Yeah.
And I was like, yeah. And the more like the second viewing really helped solidify how much I truly thought that movie failed in every way it's
almost
possible
every way
to fail.
Possible.
And again, it made me appreciate Batman v Superman because like at least that film was trying to say something, mm-hmm. and at least it was terrible, but at least it was like committed to being terrible. This movie like didn't know what it was doing, and again, even the stories that have come out about the production of the film have suggested that you know basically Ayer's original vision was completely. You know, dismantled.
Yeah. I feel like it'd be hard to argue with that. Aaron, what would you say?
You know, it was a good year for me. I think so many of the best films came out at the end of the year. Like you said, the first half was very meh. But for me, I think the top end of the movie spectrum, my top five this year have reached all time favorite status. Mm. And so I think that they're special movies that I'm going to watch over and over again. And I usually can't say that about a year. So it was so top heavy good for me that I'm going to remember it for that. But I do think that it will be remembered largely for DC's misfires. And then also the comeback from Oscars So White, as we talked about a little bit.
Yeah.
My least favorite film was Independence Day for Resurrection or Recognition or something. I don't remember what the word is.
Resurgence. I actually didn't even see that, Aaron. I'm so glad to hear that.
Well, you know what? Our Scott Kelly, another Real World Theology contributor, actually told me outright, he said, Aaron, just skip it. Skip it. Just skip it. And I did for about 2 months. And then finally one night I was like, you know, it can't be that bad. Guys, it's that bad. You know, when you have the hope, my hopes were for a 2.5-star movie. That's all they needed to give me was a 2.5-star, little bit of callback to the old movie.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what happened. I don't even know why this film was created the way it was. It is complete garbage for me. And I was just angry watching it, just angry, like mad at the screen the whole time. So,
oh, really?
Yeah.
I was
very, very sad.
I felt like I was watching a sci-fi original, and that kind of put me in a brain space where I enjoyed parts of it.
Oh. It was like Mega Shark versus Crocosaurus 7.
Yeah, yeah,
it really
maybe
was.
Maybe I should have done that. That
made it better than Suicide Squad for me. So, Gene, how about you? How will 2016 be remembered, and what was your least favorite?
My least favorite, I'm going to echo what Aaron said, Independence Day, re-something, rethink what you're doing is, I think, what it's called.
Re-examine your life choices.
Yeah, that was my least favorite by far, followed closely by Suicide Squad.
What about Zoolander 2?
Oh, my
gosh.
Another
one I skipped.
Did that come out last year? I didn't even know there was a Zoolander 2.
I may have given that 1 star. It's not. I'm looking at my Letterboxd list here. It's not on my list for some reason. I didn't add it on there. But, yeah, it's probably – gosh, that's. I'm going to say, yeah, that's worse than Independence Day. I'll say that. That's worse.
Yeah.
I had a few that I thought of that I was looking forward to but was supremely disappointed in. One of those was Free State of Jones. That was incredibly superficial, no depth at all in that film. I was really disappointed by that. And also Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, Sword of Destiny. That came out earlier in the year,
mm-hmm.
and it was a Netflix production. And I was really looking forward to it. I was hoping they could kind of recapture a lot of that magic. And it was, again, just a really empty, kind of a lifeless recreation of that. So those are my least favorite. And 2016, I think for me, is going to be remembered as like a reverse bell curve. Okay, so a bell curve is like really high in the middle and slopes downward on the sides. I would just flip that and say at the beginning of the year, I thought we got some films that had some promise. I thought Hail Caesar had some promise. Deadpool was there. I thought 13 Hours, the Michael Bay film about Benghazi, that was good. That was better than most Michael Bay films. I thought Kung Fu Panda 3 was good. I really liked that.
I did too. Right, I did too.
Yeah, 10 Cloverfield Lane right at the beginning of there. Yeah. So then you got like into like June and July, and we just all like sunk down into the reverse bell curve. And then November and December came around and lifted us back up. So I feel like we had an impeccably low blockbuster season, buttressed by – not buttressed by. That'd be on the opposite side. Whatever the word is for when it flares out like feathers. That's what the beginning and the end of the film year did for me. Flared out.
Lots of flare. Yeah, I think you all mostly, maybe except for Aaron, who's obviously a little more positive on it. I think that kind of sums up 2016. I was so disappointed in just almost the entire middle of 2016. I've told this to describe 2016 to people. In 2014 and 2015, I had no problem scheduling podcasts. I could schedule podcasts like 3 months in advance, because when a movie was advertised, you could kind of 9 times out of 10 know that it was going to be good. It was going to be worth seeing. 2016 was a mess. I was rescheduling. I was canceling episodes. I was reshifting. I was trying to figure out anything worth talking about in the middle of the year, because things were just so bad, just so not worth our time. Which I hate to say, because I typically lean on the side of something. Everything's worth your time to some degree. But it was a film that was full of mediocrity for me. I think I gave more 3-star ratings this year than I have ever. But then there was lots of stuff that didn't meet the bar. So here's a quick list of films that I thought were worse than Suicide Squad. just for Blaine, Knight of Cups. It was my least favorite film of the year. I can't stand Terrence Malick right now. And I need to go back and watch some of his older films, so maybe I can appreciate something. But I saw The Brothers Grimsby, which was incredibly awful. The Do-Over, the Adam Sandler movie on Netflix, was terrible. The Legend of Tarzan, awful. The Huntsman, Winter's War. You remember that film came out this year? It was awful. Jason Bourne, completely awful. I about fell asleep during an action movie. That's like the number one sin of an action movie. Zoolander 2, Pride and Prejudice and Zombies, which I was pretty excited about.
And you liked that less than Suicide Squad?
I did, because it just didn't do anything.
It didn't have a woman who ran. Yeah, it didn't have a woman who ran a magic sky laser by humping the air.
Yeah, but it also didn't have like what I thought was a coherent story to it. It was just like, there's zombies, I guess.
Yeah, you're zombies in Victorian England. What do you need a story for?
There you go. So, a whole list of films that I thought were worse than Suicide Squad. Now that's that is with me giving Suicide Squad 1.5 stars. So there's still a lot of really terrible movies that Independence Day Resurgence being just a slight tick above Suicide Squad. So I hope everyone has really enjoyed this first ever year in review, which I hope we get to do every year, and pseudo Oscar preview show, which we didn't go through everything, but hopefully we gave you a good idea of what we liked and disliked from this year of the films that you've probably heard the most about. So what were your feelings about 2016? We want to know, what do you think will clean house the Oscars? Come to the Real World Theology discussion group on Facebook. Let us know, comment on this episode. I'll have notes for how to contact and listen to all the shows of the guests that were on the show a little bit later, or in the show notes. So make sure you check those out. And you can always follow us at realworldtheology.com. So If you like the show, don't forget to subscribe to the podcast. We have really enjoyed this. I have enjoyed it. You know, thank you, gentlemen. And for Real World Theology, I'm Fizz, reminding you that story is powerful and entertainment is not mindless. Bye-bye.
See ya.
This podcast has been a Real World Theology production. For more information, check out realworldtheology.com. And thanks for listening.
Now this is podcasting. Woo!
hopefully it just activates poorly whenever Aaron starts talking about Suicide Squad.
No, I want every word of that defense to be clear, documented, and really
documented.
Yeah. Yep. For posterity.
I don't know why you have me on, frankly, if we're being honest.
Well.